You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Philip Metris. Philip has talked with me once before, so this is the second interview about his most recent work. Philip, thanks so much for being with me today.
I'm very grateful to be talking with you, Brainerd.
Philip, where are you talking to me from? Where are you now?
I am on the second floor of our house, looking out on our street. The magnolia has bloomed and lost its blooms, and we're in University Heights, Ohio, which is in Cleveland, basically.
And we're talking on May 7th, 2020, of course. We're, like all of these interviews lately, right in the middle of the pandemic, so that seems to color a little bit what's happening. Everyone's I guess, related to that, or it's become part of how they're producing work to different extents. But we can either like walk around that or just jump right into your most recent book.
Maybe
we should talk about what are you working on right now. We could talk about the most recent book, or we could talk about what you're working on right now in the context of this and then the most recent book.
Sure. Well, my wife had been following the story in Wuhan since December or January at the latest, and so I had the sense of the pandemic as a kind of rising wave that, you know, grew so large that it kind of has overtaken all of our lives. And seeing it in that kind of slow motion, bidding farewell to so many of my activities and my joy about releasing this book, Shrapnel Maps, into the world, it made it a little bit less traumatic, I think, and less painful. And as a result, I think that in some way, the grief process has been longer. I've flattened the curve of my grief, let's just call it that. Although, you know, obviously we're all experiencing different versions of this pandemic, and that's been on my mind a lot. Of course, we're worried about the health of our family and our parents, my parents, my wife's parents, but also just all the people who are exposed, the most vulnerable of our populations, you know, prisoners, workers, African Americans being impacted so extensively because of their often being in jobs where they're sort of on the front lines of these jobs that are still required, you know, essential services. So,
right.
Yeah, so I've been thinking about it a lot.
Well, and so let's put that in the context of your most recent book, Shrapnel Maps. You know, in it, among other things, you're discussing, or part of the content is uneasy reactions between Arab and Jewish neighbors in University Heights, where you are, as well as expulsions and Palestinians, and you know, how is that kind of sensitivity to your neighbors affect the situation you're in, we're in now, or does it? You know, I mean, I'm talking about the content of the poems of the book, but also whether that casts any particular light on this situation in terms of your neighbors and global politics.
Right. And by neighbors, you know, you're referring to the fact that I live in a predominantly Jewish Orthodox community. Although I'm, you know, I'm not part of that community. I teach at the university just down the street. And some of the interactions in the book sort of recount you know, moments of encounter and also moments of misunderstanding and moments of you know, sort of tragic difference, really. And that becomes a kind of metaphor for my thinking about how conflicts between peoples in contested spaces, you know, in Israel and Palestine in particular, sort of, you know, become toxic and accelerate. I mean, one of the interesting things about writing the book is that at various points, I particularly once it started to become real, you know, I started thinking about how will this book be received? Have I done a good enough job at depicting a reality which is perceived so differently by different people. And, you know, and just imagining friends who've lost family members in the Holocaust, for example, poet friends, you know, colleagues, and friends who've been made refugees, you know, because of the founding of the State of Israel, and who, you know, whose trauma is all, is also real, and trying to hold both of their faces and stories kind of with me as I was producing the work, and trying to kind of keep them all close to me. And I don't know, you know, it's up to the reader to decide whether I did a good enough job at doing that, but that was really my intent. And so this question you have is about, like, how, you know, now, what does this look like for me in this neighborhood? And the first thing I would just say is actually writing the book helped me process some of my grief about ways in which my daughter had been excluded and sort of not treated well by some of our neighbors. And at this moment, like when the book started coming out, I realized that, you know, like in this really like Merton-esque epiphanic moment, that passing these neighbors, that they were my brothers and sisters in this way that I hadn't been able to see, actually. So the writing was kind of incredibly cathartic for me, actually. And so, you know, I feel like there's something that happened that was just like beyond words in terms of, for me personally. Of course, that doesn't change anything about the reality that people are living with there, you know, in Israel, Palestine. And nor does it necessarily, you know, heal all, you know, relationships, but it has helped me kind of approach my neighbors in a different way. And so I see them all the time because the synagogue is right down the street from our house. And, you know, instead of feeling some sense of being watched or bitter or something, I want to say hello. I want to reach out. And now more than ever, you know, now more than ever, because, you know, people do need each other. They don't need, you know, Amazon. We need each other. So that's a long answer.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because that is a little bit of the pandemic or post-pandemic kind of social situation, right? The sense that perhaps that we need each other. I mean, I'm just kind of wading through this now because I'm rereading Camus, Albert Camus, The Plague, and he's talking about all these behaviors that people have during a plague, and they're remarkably similar, it seems, to the behaviors that we're seeing now, you know, distrust of the government, or they acted too late or too soon, or, you know, how many deaths are real or what's happening, as well as just a kind of a panic, you know, and it changing people's sense daily of what they think is solid ground in a sense. So, I mean, to speak to your neighborhood again, which we're discussing, and you're saying now more than ever, that sounds like it's palpable to you, or am I reaching? You know, I mean, like the sense of when you say we need each other, that reminds me a little also in New York after 9/11, the sense of whoa, this collective mourning and this something almost palpable about the connection you feel with your neighbor, you know, right, geographically.
Yeah, I mean, the present situation is really confusing, and partly because we've noted the tremendous evacuation of our sense of connection to the local, and part of that is just the ease of digital life and the way in which you don't really have to risk anything, you know, in digital life. But this encounter, you know, this, you know, Levinasian encounter with each other in all of our complexity and beauty and difficulty is something that we need to reinvest in, I guess, as a culture. And one of the things that, you know, as a teacher, I've been thinking a lot about how this is going to change my generation of my daughter, who's a senior in high school, and the generation of my students who are in college. And I suspect that it's going to, one possible cultural change is it's going to make them more deeply intentional about investing in real life, actually, you know, and really have a different relationship to it.
That's an interesting notion for children, for students, that this pandemic and what may be left over from it is potentially like a pull away from. I mean, if we're going that far of kind of electronic and social media to actually wanting to physically be with people more, is that what you're saying? Because that's kind of a profound thing, if so, and if that is in the works, you know.
I kind of hope that it is, that people see the limits of it, because it's, you know, the code writers, you know, in Silicon Valley have, you know, done such a great job at harvesting attention, but I do digital attention, but I think people feel, just for example, you know, the impact of Zoom on, you know, physiologically on people. On the one hand, it's this incredible opportunity to be able to still meet with people, and on the other, it's not the same as actual life, and the labor of it is palpable. It's incredible. It's you know, there's all these articles about it now. So I do think that's because, you know, these people who are losing their graduations and things like that, they'll never forget this, and they will, and I think for the first time we'll feel something differently about the actual, you know, our non-digital existence, our non-virtual existence. That's a hope. I mean, and you're right, the bigger question or issues about culture and politics, like, we could veer toward, you know, total authoritarianism, which seems to have worked for China in terms of cracking down on the virus once it was, you know, an epidemic. I mean, that's a strategy that has been used, and yet totally the opposite is, like, we see how our leadership has failed us politically, and so there's all sorts of space for people to become radicalized by it. On the left. So, yeah, I mean, we are in a really interesting place. And, you know, whether you're an optimist or a pessimist, I mean, you could really see things going in different directions for sure.
Well, it's interesting, you know, I mean, I am a bit of an optimist, but I'm aware of how dark the time is. And when I'm interviewing curators often, you know, there are also these kind of, in some cases, eternal optimists, where they're saying, you know, it's the role of artists to rebuild, to keep culture going. This is an incredible time, but it's also a time where, like, artists are all called to arms, so to speak, you know, and usually the reaction from artists is, but none of us are getting paid for any of that, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of an interesting, you know, thing that's happening, you know, what is the role of writers, of artists, and mm-hmm. culture at this time too, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, the fact that you mentioned Camus reminds us just how we do have this repository and treasury of the past of people enduring things like this. You know, suddenly people are reading Boccaccio's Decameron and that sort of thing. You know, I wrote a letter to my students. That was one of the things I did, and I talked about maybe this is an opportunity for us to develop our moral imaginations, our sense of compassion, our sense of complexity about the world, our creativity and our courage, our moral courage, which is more necessary than ever. You know, that's a lot to ask of people who, you know, are just trying to figure out how to continue.
It may not be. There's something interesting happening there, that the first Zoom talk I did a few months ago on this scale in this time was with David Ross, who was a museum director, and he talked about what he wanted to kind of tag as the great compassion. He was pulling it from another poet, and was saying that this is a time for compassion, you know, post and during tragedy like this, people have to be, or are, naturally more compassionate. And And I've noticed, strangely, in these Zoom talks, which seem to me at once kind of filled with quirks and technical problems, I've mostly done interviews, but the Zoom talks I've done, people seem to think, that there was almost something, almost a sense of community that was palpable. And it shocks me. I wrote to David, and I said, David, it is kind of shocking that these seem almost kind of warm in a way. And he said, yeah, the new compassion, or the great compassion. And I'm not sure what that means, but it's an interesting mix of what seems like compassion, as you're saying, and a technology that's not physical. You know, we're not near each other.
Mm-hmm. We had a really interesting experience like that for our celebration of graduating English majors at our university, which was, you know, we tried to do the award ceremony and things like that. And at the end, I was supposed to curate sort of conversations, you know, sort of like what you would do after an award ceremony, an opportunity for people to talk in smaller groups. And I had some struggle with the breakout rooms on Zoom. I wasn't the host, so someone had to make me the host. And while we were waiting, I said, listen, we could do the breakout rooms, but we could also just continue to be here together. There must have been 50 people on the Zoom. And please raise your hand if you would prefer to go into breakout rooms. No one raised their hand. They all wanted to be together because they can't gather in big groups now anyway, in the sense of being together was so was something that they thirsted for, and they wanted just to be there. And students said the most lovely things, you know, about their experience kind of at the university and their thanks for various professors who had mentored them and that sort of thing. And it struck me that, that the technology does enable certain ways of connection, and some things are happening which are different. And I certainly would have never, and I repeat, like almost never have, you know, wanted to do an online reading or, you know, a talk or like that before this. And now...
And is that happening? You know, because that's what we didn't mention. So for Shrapnel Maps, and there will be a link in here so people can read more about it or buy it. But as you were saying, for Shrapnel Maps, I think you were about to say earlier in the interview, you were about to go on tour. Things would have happened. So instead, were there online readings? Is that what you're about to say or no?
I've probably done like, I don't know, four or five at this point, and we'll continue to do them for different audiences with different writers and different kind of communities. And they've been good. They've been opportunities for me to think about how to, deliver the work in a way that's different, you know, that that brings it to life. To talk to people, not at people, that's really, really tricky with the technology because you're looking at yourself on these screens.
Right. It's so weird. But so explain that more. Go into that. So you feel like you're not talking at people with Zoom, but you might be in a traditional reading kind of thing?
Right. I mean, that's to me, it's so important as someone who's reading or performing the work that there is this symbiosis between the performer in the audience, which you really need to kind of hear where people are, if they're paying attention, if they're interested, if they're connecting, and what you know, jokes, things like that. There's no way you can do a joke if there's silence, you know. But there are these feedback loops, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the functions have, you know, chat functions or, you know, various audience reaction functions, and that does help a little bit. But just to kind of, you know, to reimagine what it would be like to talk with someone in this, you know, really impersonal kind of technology where there isn't that kind of direct physical presence.
It's fascinating. It's so true. It's such a new world, you know.
For sure.
Of communication. So yeah. I want to wish you well with your book, Shrapnel Maps. Again, it's linked to here. And I want to ask you one more question, which is, what are you reading at the moment?
Reading? Well, all manner of things. I'm looking around my desk to see what I'm reading. In addition to student papers, this lovely book just came out by another poet named George Abraham, Palestinian-American poet, called Birthright, which I found just, I had read it in proof, and now I see the actual thing. He's an incredibly powerful up-and-comer. That's one. I have Dostoevsky. I'm trying to read my daughter some various Russians. Cause I think now more than ever, the Russians make a certain amount of sense.
That's great. What are you reading to her? You're reading her Dostoevsky.
I read her Gogol's Nose. I read her a Chekhov story. Reading a little bit of The Brothers Karamazov to her, and just trying to. She's in eighth grade. And she's precocious, so she's right at the age where some of this stuff is like making sense. She really liked the Gogol. She really loved the Nose. So I mean, it's absurd, and we're living in absurd times. So, kind of makes a certain amount of sense.
Yeah, it does. It does. Philip, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today. It's really been a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Brandon. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.